get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today we want to continue our analysis and discussion of global financial instability trends. Last week we identified what some of the discussions are currently about some of the areas of growing financial instability. We made reference to increasing number of reports. Official reports warning about financial instability and possible financial bubbles that are beginning to appear in various places. And if you read the business press, the global business press, we're seeing more and more references to that very subject. In other words, growing financial bubbles and debt that finances those bubbles, and leveraging debt to invest in financial asset markets, which we've talked about repeatedly here on the show. That's the problem with debt on the business side. You see, that kind of accumulation of debt on the household side does not lead to financial bubbles, nor does government debt lead to financial bubbles, whether federal or state and local. What leads to financial bubbles is private debt, investor debt, corporate debt, the wealthiest 1% debt, because we have this trend in the last few decades of those folks, instead of investing in real investment that produces real jobs and real income, at least in the U.S. or in advanced economies, they are investing in financial assets, both in the advanced economies, Europe, U.S., North Asia, Japan particularly, to some extent South Korea, Taiwan, and, of course, investing in financial asset markets in emerging markets, Latin America, Asia, etc., because the money is flowing to the extent it is going into real investment, it's flowing into real investment in those regions. The central banks, as I point out in my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, have at least for the last decade been fueling this emerging market expansion, because the money that they create electronically at make it so attractive for banks to borrow from them, near zero interest rates, that money flows out of the advanced economies, particularly the U.S., and it goes to emerging markets, stimulating expansion of commodities and manufacturing and so forth, which is facilitated by all of these free trade agreements. You know, free trade is really about money flows. Not so much, I wouldn't deny it has to do with goods and service flows, but you read these free trade agreements, NAFTA and so forth, a lot of it is dedicated to enabling, facilitating U.S. money capital to flow into Mexico and help investing of U.S. multinational corporations that move their operations to these areas. They just don't move on their own. They move along with the money flow, or the money flow moves along with them, vice versa, both ways. And we get an expanding real economies in emerging markets, financed by the cap money capital flows, which ultimately can be traced back to the central banks, including primarily the Federal Reserve. So when these economies and emerging markets begin to expand, so do their financial markets, stock and bond markets. So the money flows out not only to financing real investment expansion in real goods and services in emerging markets, but it flows out to speculate in the stock, bond, derivative markets, foreign exchange in those countries as well. So you get a double whammy kind of money capital outflow into emerging markets. Excuse me. And, of course, a big benefactor of that has been China as an emerging market now transitioning to a major market, or already has in some ways. It has characteristics of both emerging market and advanced economy markets. So, we've talked about that time and time again, and the money flows create bubbles in those emerging markets as well. Last week, we identified what we called the bubbles in emerging markets, the dollarized corporate bond market, especially in Latin America, I might say. Companies in Latin America are issuing corporate bonds in dollar terms. Well, but what happens with U.S. interest rates, which will affect those bonds and the bond markets? Well, we'll see. And that's why I've been predicting that the Fed will not raise rates appreciably or significantly because it will endanger U.S. multinational corporations and U.S. investors who have invested heavily in emerging markets. It will mean if the dollar rises as a result of U.S. rate rises too much, that causes a collapse or decline in the currencies of those emerging markets, and therefore when U.S. multinational corporations try to convert their profits earned in those markets into dollars, they take a loss, and it can be a big exchange rate loss, even more in some cases than the profits they earn, which are significant in those emerging markets, if the exchange rate movements are too harsh. So that's why the Fed is not going to raise. I mean, it's looking at the emerging markets, and it's looking at the U.S. multinational corporations, GE and others, and it's going to make sure that it doesn't cause a currency instability. Another reason why the U.S. Federal Reserve will not raise rates significantly is that it's pretty clear that Europe and Japan are going to keep their currencies low. If the U.S. raises rates, it will drive the value of the dollar up even more, and that will choke off not only U.S. Exports, but it will cause this problem of exchange rate volatility, and the U.S. is not going to do that as long as Europe and Japan insist on their central banks continuing to pump massive amounts of money, even though they slow it down a little bit in Europe, into their economies to keep their exchange rate low, you see. All this Fed money injection and low rates cannot be separated from exchange rate policy and therefore export-driven growth, which is Europe and to some extent Japan. So, as long as the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan keep pumping money in their QE into their economies to keep their rates low, the U.S. Is not going to allow its rates to rise too much and therefore cause an even greater gap in the currency relationship between the U.S. and the euro and the yen. It's not going to do that. Another third reason why the central bank will not raise interest rates appreciably, I believe, is that, as I've said in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, it's got a ceiling of about 2% for the what's called the federal funds rate, which is the key rate for the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank. It's at 1.25 now. It can't raise it above 2% without causing a credit crunch and therefore a recession in the United States. Or you can look at another indicator, the 10-year Treasury bond, which is somewhere around 2.3%. percent cannot go above 3%. Okay, so they have a little more room to raise rates, and Janet Yellen is going to continue to raise rates while she's there until she's gone. All this talk about Yellen being reappointed by Trump is nonsense. Will never happen. And in fact, Trump is now making the rounds talking to the candidates that who may replace Yellen. And I believe Yellen was supposed to meet with him today. All this talk is she may be, also continuing. And of course, for some reason, that meeting did not happen, unprecedented, after an announced meeting with the Fed chair. It's canceled. Something happened behind the scenes. Anyway, Yellen is out. And who is going to replace her? Well, we will see. Candidates include, John Taylor, who will not be a finalist, and this guy Powell, who was an assistant, was a governor, I believe, and Gary Cohn, who was the Goldman Sachs former CEO, who is now head of Trump's Council on Economics. I've been saying that Cohn, the Goldman Sachser, has an inside track, but we will see whether it's him or Powell or Kevin Warsh. But whatever it is, there will not be any major change in Federal Reserve Central Bank policy, whoever is appointed. There never is. There's always continuity because the big bankers make sure that what they want in terms of monetary policy has continuity across time. And this has been the case since the 1986 when Paul Volcker got fired. He was the Fed chair there. He got fired because he would not go along with the consensus at the time. And ever since then, we've had Greenspan, who's provided this what we call liquidity put. In other words, keep pumping all the liquidity into the economy that the bankers want. And, of course, Ben Bernanke followed suit, did the same, who's running around now making $250,000, giving speeches to bankers. In other words, they pay them well, reward them well. Corruption is legal in the U.S. And now Yellen continued the Bernanke Greenspan continuity in terms of liquidity, provided cheap money to the banks. And then whoever replaces Yellen will pretty much follow suit there. Stability, they make sure that the capitalists make sure that the free money is going to continue for quite some time, or near free money. You see, the Fed faces a contradiction, and that is if it doesn't raise rates, it's got no ammunition, or less ammunition for the next recession that's coming, and yet they want the free money and the low rates. So the Fed's now raising rates a little bit, can't raise it much more, to get a little bit of a cushion to lower rates in the next recession. And the free money is not quite so free. You know, it used to be like 0.1%. Now it's 1.25%. And so it's costing a little bit. But I would love to get a loan for my new car for 1.25%, wouldn't you? Yeah, that's not so bad. Or a house. Would you want to buy a house mortgage at 1.25% interest rate? Yeah, but not going to happen. Only the banks get those kind of deals. As I've argued in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, this free money for decades now is a good example of how the capitalist economic system has to continue to be subsidized. The financial side is continuously subsidized, and increasingly so, by the central bank. Free money, virtually. The other form of subsidization is corporate investor tax cuts, and we're seeing that play out at the same time. In fact, we've been seeing that play out increasingly since 2001. So the state The capitalist state is subsidizing the system in a number of ways to keep it afloat, the free money from the central bank, and tax cuts for corporations and investors. And we're seeing the Trump tax play out. What we can conclude from what's going on now with the Federal Reserve and the reappointment of Yellen's successor, and the Trump tax, which is priority number one now, working its way through legislation, is that if the state central bank side of the state raises rates and therefore reduces the free money slightly for the system, that's more than offset by big tax cuts for corporations and investors. And that's what this is about. That's what this tax cut is about and why it will go through, because they believe they need to raise rates as much as they can. And they're going to offset that cost increase by a cost cut in the form of tax cuts for corporations and investors. So you see, they play the fiscal policy tax cut, and they play the monetary policy interest rate game jointly, one offsetting the other. And in times of real serious crisis, like 2008 and 2009, they cut both of them massively and flood the investor class with even more free money. And now, of course, what they're doing is trying to raise rates slightly. But they can't, for the reasons I've already stated. So they're going to have to give big corporate tax cuts and investor tax cuts, individual investors, not just corporations, but investor tax cuts, you see. When you cut that personal income tax to 20% that he's proposing, that's an investor tax cut, because it's that 1% that owns and does most of the investing in securities, financial securities. And then you cut the corporate tax rate that Trump is proposing. And for non-corporate businesses, you give a huge windfall by reducing the business pass-through income, which is a tax cut for non-corporate businesses, as massive as the tax cuts are for corporate and personal. And then how are you going to pay for this is the next question, and that's being debated right now. And, of course, this all has to do with helping the stock market stay afloat and rise to ever greater heights and further into bubble territory. If you don't believe that the tax cuts have to do with stimulating the stock market, well, I would just refer you to a statement by Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, just a few days ago this past week. What did he say? He said, if you don't pass the tax cut, right, there will be a significant problem in the stock markets. They will shed a, quote, significant amount of their recent gains if lawyers do not pass tax reform. That's a quote from this guy, okay? As he said in a podcast, there's, quote, no question that the rally in the stock market has baked into it reasonably high expectations of us getting tax cuts. Well, they call it tax reform, see, but it has nothing to do with reform. It's not changing anything. Reform implies you're going to change something that's not working at present. Well, it's working fine for the investor class, all these tax cuts since George Bush, at present, and they're just going to expand and continue it. So it can't be reform of anything. No, it's just another big tax cut, right? He says equities stocks would, quote, go up higher if the reform, a.k.a. tax cut, right, were passed. Well, okay, you know, the free money, low interest rate was being borrowed by the banks and through the banks to investors, and that money, as I've argued in my book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy in 2016, flowing into financial markets, giving us this big bubble in stocks and other financial markets, but the stock market. And now that big feeder is being, I wouldn't say reduced, but being slowed, now they're going to open the spigot on the tax cut side to funnel even more money capital. In other words, you keep more of your super profits, investors, that you made from the free money from the Fed. See, now you get to keep it and reinvest it again and even more. Well, you know, the stock market, the Dow, and, of course, the other two major markets, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, have followed the Dow, or they follow each other. You know, that the Dow is a good example. From 6,500 level in 2008 at its nadir, it's clearly approaching 24,000, 25,000. Oh, well, what is that? That's like 400% increase. Well, you know, that's why you know, these corporations and investors are getting 95% of all the net income gains in this country since 2009-10. 95% has gone to the 1%. Wow. And that's why we've got $1 trillion a year in dividend payouts and stock buybacks for the last 6 years, you know, which is responsible for that 95% gain. It's financial assets and financial capital gains that are really driving the income inequality in the U.S. But, you know, you don't hear that talked about too much. You hear about income inequality discussed in terms by economists mainstream. You know, it's the lack of wage income growth, which is true. I'm not saying that doesn't contribute. It does to the inequality trends. Or they focus on CEO pay, you know, which is like 5% of total corporate profits, something like that. Don't point the finger at the real causes. So you know, if you don't believe that the stock market is being driven by Fed policy, and now and increasingly, relatively now, by tax policy, just go back and listen to Steve Mnuchin's podcast here of the past week, and you know, he'll admit it. He'll admit it. By the way, other quotes of particular interest here. The central bank, head of the Central Bank of China, who is retiring now, Zhu, I think his name is. Yeah, I think his name is Zhu. He came out with an interesting quote this past week. Of course, you know, China's Central Committee had the party conference here this past week, and we're going to see a shift, I believe, in the policy. Up until now, while Xi was, you know, chairman there, premier, whatever, president, I think he is, head of the Communist Party and the government there, they pulled out all the plugs to make sure the economy was stimulated and booming for the last 9 months in anticipation of the party conference. You know, they've let the speculation run a little bit up until now. They don't want to crack down too hard on the speculators causing bubbles over there until the party conference. But watch, they will crack down now on them. Because there's a real problem, we'll talk about it at the end of the show, with bubbles in China. You know, we got this U.S. stock bubble very clearly, right? 25,000 from 6,500 level. Well, we had a big stock bubble in China in 2015 that was squelched by party party policies, economic policies in China. They pricked that bubble and deflated it, and the money from all the money made from the bubble, wealthy Chinese investors attempted to take it out of the country, which was causing a problem devaluation in their currency, so much demand for other currencies with using Chinese funds depressed the Chinese currency. And about a year or so ago, there was a big worry, early 2016, that China would have to devaluate, and that would send reverberate throughout all the other currencies globally, and they would have to devaluate too and cause great instability. Well, China was able to contain that devaluation of the currency and the attempt by Chinese investors to send their money out. And then it shifted once again and allowed bubbles to occur in China. Instead of the money flowing out, it redirected the money capital in China into new bubbles. And the new bubbles, of course, are asset management, wealth management products, which are kind of an asset management product, which is kind of derivative for wealthy folks to put their money in. If they couldn't put it in stocks, they moved it into WIMPs, wealth management products, WMPs. And we got a bubble over there of $1 trillion in WMPs. Well, watch the Chinese to crack down on that bubble. And, of course, there are other bubbles also been, you know, rising and ebbing in China in what's called entrusted loans, which are really another name for junk bonds for state-owned enterprises, which are being kept afloat by refinancing old debt with this new junk debt. Just keep rolling it over, which is blessed by the state-owned banking system there in China to keep them from collapsing. Because if they collapse, those state-owned enterprises, you'd have massive unemployment. And, you know, the Chinese workers have a tendency when they lose their jobs to take action, at least locally, marginally, or in these cities where these old state-owned enterprises are, mostly in the north. So there's a bubble there, too, which probably can be contained in entrusted loans, Chinese junk bonds, a.k.a. Chinese junk bonds. And then you have local government financing vehicles, as they're called, LGFVs, which have been responsible for over-leveraging, over-borrowing, stimulating real estate markets, particularly in the large cities there. That's been going on up and down since 2011 in China. And the whole history of Chinese policy in the last 6 years has been attempting to contain these bubbles with policies that then slow down the economy, the real economy, and then China reverses its course and takes whatever action is necessary to get the economy going again, which is pumping more money into the economy, which reignites these bubbles. And it's kind of like a whack-a-mole, you know, that little game where you whack things when they pop up, kids do. Kind of policy response, trying to balance keeping real growth going and trying to contain these financial bubbles because the liquidity that's been pumped up in China since 2011-12 has been massive. And that's why total debt in China, driven mostly by this private debt, is like 260% of GDP. Two, three times with GDP, which is like 10, 11 trillion of debt in China, a rising debt in China. Not just government debt, but private sector debt. And that's probably an underestimation because no one really knows, you know, really accurately how much total debt, private debt there is in China. But it's big. It's big. And, you know, the IMF and the World Bank and these other Western research, capitalist research institutions keep warning about it. Well, China has like $4 trillion in reserves. It can probably weather a financial instability event in any one of these bubble markets. But even if China is able to contain it, it will have such a psychological contagion effect on other markets, spilling over, and the other markets may not be able to be as successful emerging markets in containing any contagion from a bubble cracking in China. Okay, so, you know, U.S. stocks, bubble, clearly. And we should talk about what's driving the bubble in the U.S. We just talked about China. Let's talk about the bubble in the U.S., the stock bubble. And clearly, the stock bubble in the U.S. Has run another leg up since the Trump has come to office. We sometimes call it the Trump trade. That's ebbed and flowed, but U.S. stocks are clearly at least 15% up in the last 6-7 months alone, which is quite a bit in the last 6 or 7 months. Well, what's driving the bubble in U.S. stocks? Well, if we look at it, several forces here. One is the expectations of corporations and investors that the tax cut is coming, you see. That's going to put a big windfall profit in their pockets. Big, big. Yeah, they talk about $1.5 trillion, Congress and others talk about $2.4 trillion, and this would just be the first round. You know, if later in Trump's administration here, if he lasts, I think definitely they'll have another round of this. But anyway, you know, $2 trillion, pretty good as an average. Well, that's going to be driven by the tax cuts, the subsidization of investors and corporations as a result of these tax cuts that are coming, because the lion's share of it goes to the wealthy and their institutions, you see. And as I said, as the federal funds rate, which was the main force of subsidy, begins to ebb a little bit as the Fed raises rates a little bit, the tax cuts are going to more than offset that as a form of state subsidy of corporations and investors. Right? So that expectation of a windfall, excess money capital, they don't have to pay in taxes, that anticipation, expectation, is driving the demand for stocks to some extent. Okay. There's also an expectation among investors that Trump will appoint a Fed chair that will keep rates low, relatively low, even though the rates may rise, you know, another 0.5% or so. At most, they won't rise much more than that. You know, the markets and investors are looking at the Fed. The Fed says it's going to raise rates three or four times next year, but the markets know they won't. The markets know that the Fed can't and won't because it's being constrained from doing so by those forces I talked about earlier, and that's the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan, keeping their rates very low, and the fears in emerging markets and multinational corporations that too much of a rate hike will result in an escalation of the U.S. dollar, and that will devastate their profits. So that's not going to happen, right? But it's that expectation that the Fed will not really raise rates that dramatically. That is also driving the market, along with the expectation of big corporate tax cuts, investor tax cuts coming. And now, in addition to the policy forces driving stocks into bubble, increasingly bubble territory, there is a technical trends at the same time at play here that are also contributing to the stock market bubbles in the U.S. What are they? One is this structural shift to what's called passive investing. Passive investing is where instead of trying to pick stocks, investors now are putting their money into these funds. primarily exchange-traded funds, ETFs they're called, and they're linking, indexing the investments to the stocks that are rising. In other words, ETFs will, the money will flow into whatever corporate stocks are continuing to do well. And now that money flowing into them means they will continue to do well as the demand for those stocks raises the price for those stocks. But what happens is that the winners keep winning as a result of this passive investing, the winning corporations, and the losers keep losing, you see. And you get this bifurcation in the stock market of fewer and fewer big companies who are doing better and better in terms of the stock price, and the rest of them are being left behind. That's a very unhealthy situation in the stock market, and it's just begging for a correction here. So a few big corporations are driving these stock prices. It's not a broad-based stock price increase, and you can see it really clearly in the Nasdaq tech side, where you have what's called the FANGs: Facebook, Alphabet, Google, right, Netflix, and Amazon, and to some extent Microsoft. Okay, they're really driving the stock prices here. So not just passive investing, indexing, ETFs. Think of ETFs, by the way, as the new derivatives and the new derivative danger. And they are derivatives, right? In the last crisis, it was subprime mortgages driven by what were called derivatives of mortgage-backed securities and commercial property-backed securities and credit default swaps, et cetera, right? Those were the bad guys of the last derivative-driven contagion escalated crash that occurred. Well, now it's ETFs, I believe. At the same time, we have new trends like dark pool investing, where the really rich folks quietly invest, and no one knows what they're invested in because the stocks they're investing in don't get reflected on the stock market. Private investing by the super rich, you see. And then there's automated trades based upon price trends, right? You have all this software-based automated buying. And so you combine that with the ETFs, the indexing, and the passive investing, and the automated trades, it just keeps driving these prices up and up. But no price can keep going up and up without some exception at some point. But when the stock prices bubbles correct, they will correct exceptionally fast. Which brings us to the 1987 crash, which is a stock market crash in the U.S., which this week is the 30th anniversary. In fact, yesterday, the 19th, was the 30th anniversary of the great crash in 1987, where stocks corrected more than 20% in one day. Well, it was not dissimilar from what's going on now. The Federal Reserve started pumping free money into the economy. Paul Volcker, who was the chair at the time before the crash, disagreed with that broad-based capitalist strategy let's drive towards financialization, just as they were driving towards globalization, moving everything offshore, manufacturing and so forth, begins under Reagan, of course. Also, the decision was made by U.S. capitalist policymakers that they're going to financialize the economies more, as well as globalize with free trade and foreign direct investment and so forth. Well, Volcker balked at that, and he got himself fired, you see. Reagan's Treasury guy running the show, James Baker, and others, you know, wanted this trend. By that time, Reagan was pretty much demented, I believe, and he wasn't running anything after in the second term. So Volcker was fired, and Greenspan comes in and replaces him, and he opens the spigots. Well, Volcker opened them some before that, and then didn't want to open them anymore. And what we got was a junk bond boom. And that junk bond boom, which was going on about mid-80s, was fueling the mergers and acquisitions boom that was going, bubble that was going on at the same time. In other words, raising money, leveraged money with junk bonds, corporate junk bonds, to fund the purchases of these companies, a lot of them in retail. And, of course, the demand for buying the stock up as part of these takeovers of companies drove up the price of the stock. And that was the whole idea, you see, of the speculators like Milliken and others. I forget the names of some of the others. They would borrow the money, and they would buy the stock of these companies they wanted to take over. It would drive up the stock of the company they wanted to take over. When they took it over, right, they split the company up, kept the good part, sold off the other part, the stock collapses, and therefore, at some point, it became clear that the market was being, it was in bubble territory in 87 as a result of this whole bubble, a junk bond-driven bubble, and then it collapsed in October of 87. Right, the money. A lot of the money rotated out of that into savings and loan and real estate, which caused another bubble. You see, the money in these bubbles doesn't go away. It just moves around. It doesn't disappear. It goes. Those who get out and make a killing put their money in somewhere else. Hopefully, they try to find something similar. Well, they found, the housing market speculation as a nice place to put it. And the deregulations assisted it under Reagan, and we got another bubble in real estate that busted as well, almost simultaneously. And then we had a bailout of the savings and loans that cost $300 billion. Some of these guys went to jail at the time. They don't go to jail anymore. You know, Milken and some of them. Others, I forget their names, Boisky, I think his name was. They did jail time, and these SNL guys did jail time as well for their excesses and precipitating the recession. If you watched a famous movie of the time, Wall Street, right, was the movie with a character called Gordon Gekko. Man, famous line of Gordon Gekko, greed is good. Well, that summarized not only the 1980s and the Reagan period, but the whole shift, the whole financial speculative shift that's been ongoing here since the Reagan time, right? So that's just a little comparison. We got, you know, similar trends going on in the stock market, similar being driven by different forces. And the same thing happened, of course, with the dot-com bust and boom in 2000-2001, over-speculation fed by Greenspan pumping over the 1990s more and more money into the economy, free money into the economy, and the global economy as well. And that ended up with the dot-com tech bust in 2000-2001, precipitated another recession in 2001, which was blunted only by the fact that the U.S. went to war with 9/11. It was that massive government spending that quickly followed that offset the recession to some extent. And by the way, you know, we have the recession in 1990-91 offset by the first Gulf War. So you got to ask yourself, wow, you know, it looks pretty much a high correlation here between financial bubbles that bust, drag down the real economy, and wars which attempt to somehow offset that stimulus. Well, we got the same thing in 2000-2001. I believe the 2003 Iraq invasion was related to the economy to some extent, that Bush could not get going again. And they had stimulated the housing market all they could artificially that would lead, you know, eventually to the crash in housing. So they needed even more stimulus because the economy was slowing by 2002 and 3, even though interest rates were at 1%. You know, I think 2003, to some extent, the Iraq war was a response to a weak economy in the wake of the 2001 recession, recovery from which did not proceed as well as they had thought it would. And, of course, we get the 1% interest rates as well to stimulate the economy along with the Iraq invasion. And the hope was that that would get George Bush another term in 2004, which it did. You know, if the economy had continued to sink and there were no Iraq war and the Federal Reserve did not drop interest rates to 1%, I don't think Bush would have got reelected in 2004. Now, Bush rewarded his buddy Greenspan in exchange for that by giving him another term until 2006, you see. So these guys play back and forth, you know, which makes a joke out of this idea that the Federal Reserve is independent. No, no, it's not. Okay, so we've talked about bubbles in China. We talked about stock bubbles right now in the U.S. and what's driving it, expectations and technical trends that appear to be continuing, and that the Fed will not raise rates significantly, and therefore the stock bubble will continue here in the U.S., given these technical trends. A little historical comparison with 87, but let's talk about another bubble that is so obvious that no one dare say it's not a bubble, and that's cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in the U.S. How much of a bubble? Well, 6 months ago, Bitcoin was trading at $1,000 a coin. Well, what is it trading at now? Almost $6,000 a coin. If that's not a bubble, then bears don't live in the woods, okay? Well, what's driving the cryptocurrency bubble? Well, it's all this excess shadow banking financing that's going on. There's so much money out there. Speculators see the possibility of making even a greater, quicker capital gains by investing in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. There's a whole bunch of them. Ethereum's another, right? The latest, I think, I read about was Tezos, they call them. I mean, there's so many of them. Why? Why are there so many cryptocurrencies emerging? Because they're funding ICOs, you know, initial coin offerings, ICOs. You know, when a company initiates stock, selling stocks is called IPOs, initial public offerings, right? So we have this thing called initial coin offerings. And, you know, it's pretty much unregulated here, but it's a real bubble going on right now in ICOs, right? Even some of the big bankers have warned against this, like Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, right, who was warning against these cryptocurrencies, a lot of money flowing into these things and driving up the price. Well, why is the money flowing into the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin is associated with this new technological innovation in finance and banking called blockchain. Blockchain is really a way of which banks will speed up the payment, payment between banks and financial institutions. You see, now it's kind of a clunky system called the SWIFT system, where it takes days to reconcile payments across banks, across geographic regions. Well, as part of the global financialization trend that's been going on for some time, they want to speed up the flow of money globally. Now, once they get blockchain and they speed up the flow of money, that will accelerate what's called money velocity. And that will make the creation of these financial bubbles globally and the money flowing around between the bubbles even a greater trend, right? Money velocity will increase even more so than before. Now, why is that important? Well, it has to do with price trends and interest rates and other trends, related trends we won't get into, but it's going to really destabilize things even more, right? Well, we got these bubbles going on in initial coin offerings everywhere, right? And the big bankers and big investors are trying to figure out a way how to get in and participate, and because it's usually more innovative folks who are building the software competing. See, there's different competitive sources for this blockchain. And they're the ones who are, as they develop the software, they're offering ICOs. And venture capitalists are pouring money into this thing. And so it's the blockchain technology that's driving the Bitcoin and other offerings, similar cryptocurrencies, and the demand to invest in blockchain and coin offerings is running away from itself, right? New types of fundraising, in other words, shadow banking, as I call it, right? They may not even be trading in the coins, like Tezos, T-E-Z-O-S tokens, right? Kind of a coin, crypto coin, right? They're not even trading in it, and people are plowing money into those companies, particularly the company that's developing crypto, another crypto offering, right? Ripple is another one. Ethereum is another one. And the prices in 2017 for these some of these currencies have risen thousands of percent. You know, Bitcoin, the most well-known, is, you know, what, 2,000%? But some of them, like Ethereum, you know, have risen like 8,000%. That's because they're newer, you see. But we're talking about thousands of percent here. When we had the dot-com bubble, we were talking about hundreds of percent. The NASDAQ rose 600%. Well, from about 200 to 400% above its early 1990s level. Right? And then, of course, it came down just as fast to almost zero here. Well, not zero, maybe about, you know, 100% over its 1993 virtual zero levels. So the NASDAQ.com bubble pales compared to this bubble here, Cole, with the cryptocurrencies. Right? And, of course, we got stock bubbles as well, rising hundreds of percent here. All right, so what are some so cryptocurrencies are a bubble. To what extent these cryptocurrencies, when they bust, and it won't be too much longer, I don't think, 2018, for sure, you can't go with $6,000 a coin from virtually less than $1,000 a coin in 6 months and not have a bubble effect here, particularly with all the cryptos driving behind, coming behind. What are some of the other bubbles here? Well, you've got government bonds in Europe. That's a problem once again. That was a big problem in the periphery of Europe, but it's a problem once again. Why? Catalonia. Yeah, Catalonia is the word. And Italian banks, you see. Italian banks make their government bonds high risk, so the rate at those bonds, to sell those bonds, rises significantly. Well, with all this talk about Catalonia seceding from Spain, it's driven Spanish bonds into the same level as Italian bonds, government bonds. Right, it's going to affect all of the periphery of Europe, and if that's an indicator, you know, as Europe begins to spin out and spin off these smaller tribe countries, Europe's just a tribe, bunch of tribes who have never been able to unite. If that happens, you know, we will see a repeat. But Catalonia looks like it's going for a real toss-up here between the central government, very conservative reactionary Rajoy government, taking a very hard line against Catalonia. We saw that when they sent in SWAT teams to disrupt the voting on whether they should secede or not, go independent or not. I mean, a good example is the difference in democracy in the UK and Spain, right? The UK let the vote happen with Scotland, right? But what does Spain do? You know, because there's fascist traditions in Spain still there. They send in SWAT teams to disrupt the vote. What a dumb thing to do. Disrupt democracy, right? Well, you know, the fight is still going on there. And all these warnings are forthcoming from the state government, national government, that they're going to crack down hard. They're probably going to throw people in jail in government, in the regional government. Well, what's going to happen? We will see what happens. Well, that's going to all have a big impact on bonds, not only in Spain, but throughout Europe. And another reason why the ECB is going to keep the free money flowing, because they don't know the economic destabilizing effects that will result from this fight over there in Spain over Catalonian independence, right? Italian bonds, the Italian banks are still hundreds of billions of euros in debt, and they haven't been able to bail them out. Another reason why the ECB will keep its money free. And then we got Brexit, which appears to be in trouble and going to be messy, and that will be another reason for instability in Europe. So, you know, to quickly sum up here, we talked about U.S. stock bubble, we talked about cryptocurrencies bubble, we talked about junk bond bubbles in U.S. and Europe, by the way, we didn't mention that much, the 87 crash, emerging market dollarized bonds, and China and Europe bonds. Well, these are all financial instabilities growing and deeper, and they will continue. Okay, next week we will continue this discussion. And maybe we'll know more about the Fed chair appointment.